Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. With cases of the COVID-19 Delta variant rising sharply across our region, county officials are warning that over 99% of new COVID cases, hospitalizations, and deaths are among unvaccinated people. The county's newly approved budget is a dramatic shift from prior years, with many new spending priorities aimed at helping the most vulnerable, and we'll have details on today's show. The state has expanded its drought declaration and is asking all California residents to help conserve water, although the request remains voluntary for now. An injured mountain lion is back in the wild thanks to a wildlife rehab center in Ramona. The Tyson Company has issued a recall on frozen, pre-cooked chicken products that were sold at major retail outlets as well as distributed to institutions such as schools and nursing homes. In La Mesa, a special election has been set for November to fill the vacancy left by Dr. Akilah Weber, the first African American to serve on the city council. The election will be held by mail, and if you want to run to serve on La Mesa's city council, the filing deadline starts July 12th and runs through August 6th. Our newsmaker interview today is with El Cajon Councilman Gary Kendrick. We'll be talking about the city's newly adopted police reforms, efforts to help the homeless, and a proposal to help prevent false residency claims by candidates for city offices. And then on Bookshelf, Raina Menashe will be interviewing Stephen McGinty, author of The Dive, the untold story of the world's deepest submarine rescue, and some of the heroes in this amazing true tale are from San Diego. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
This is Angela Kurish with a health report from East County Magazine. San Diego County has released data revealing that San Diegans who are not fully vaccinated account for 99.8% of all deaths and hospitalizations since January, as well as 99.1% of all cases countywide. The vaccines are protecting San Diegans even as the new and more dangerous Delta variant is circulating in our region. NPR reports that the Delta variant spreads twice as easily as a variant first found in England, which in turn was twice as easily spread as the original strain. The Delta variant is also more deadly than the original COVID-19 virus. Dr. Seema Shah, Medical Director of Epidemiology and Immunization Services for the county, says, "The data shows that we've known all along. The COVID-19 vaccines are very effective at preventing serious illness and deaths." She urges everyone who hasn't yet been vaccinated or who still needs to get a second shot to get fully vaccinated now to be safe and limit the spread of the virus. To date, the county has administered over 4.1 million doses of the vaccine. Nearly 79% of all San Diegans age 12 and up are now fully vaccinated, and over 67% are partially vaccinated.
San Diego County's Board of Supervisors have voted unanimously to adopt a $7.23 billion revised budget for fiscal year 2021-22. The adopted budget responds to voices in the community and follows a framework for the future that will fundamentally change county operations, with significant funding to address justice system reform, racial justice, health and environmental equity, homelessness, and economic opportunity. County Chief Administrative Officer Helen Robbins-Meyer said, "This is a budget that meets the needs of all our residents," adding that the budget is stretching, but maintaining a prudent and responsible fiscal position. The budget reflects new priorities in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic that has caused hardships for many San Diegans, and also reflects the board's shift to a Democratic majority after decades of Republican control, though all five supervisors backed the revised budget. The approved budget is a 10.4% increase over last year's budget. It includes funds for the county fire department to create 3-member teams and 3 remote fire stations. The revised budget prioritizes justice system reform, focusing on preventative over punitive measures and expanded reentry support for those in the justice system to reduce recidivism and result in more positive outcomes. Medical care and access to mental health services will be expanded throughout the jail system with 141 additional staff, and $12.5 million will expand the Mobile Crisis Response Team program, used as an alternative to dispatching law enforcement for people in crisis. The budget also provides the Sheriff's Department with 58 extra employees and increased funding to expand medication-assisted treatment services in county jails, which have the highest rate of prisoner deaths in the state. The county is also investing $75 million for Phase 2 of the new Youth Transition Campus to move away from a traditional punitive model that operates like a jail to one that fosters positive youth development and is shown to support improved outcomes. The Public Defender's Office has funds for a one-year pilot program for immigrant rights legal defense, also offering translation services to detained immigrants. The revised budget also funds a new Office of Equity and Racial Justice to support equity in county programs and new projects, such as an initiative designed to uplift boys and men of color. The budget also prioritizes support for behavioral health, such as mobile outreach, lowering staff-to-client ratios, and enhancing crisis stabilization services. The budget also funds 23 nurses supporting the San Diego County Psychiatric Hospital, which provides services to some of San Diego County's most vulnerable residents. The COVID-19 pandemic underscores the need for health equity. The budget invests in diversely targeted outreach for hard-hit neighborhoods and other vulnerable populations, continued testing, treatment, and tracing efforts, and meals for at-risk seniors. Funding will also advance health equity in racial and ethnic minority groups and rural populations. The budget also increases funding to add 166 additional positions to meet increased demand for safety net services, including the CalFresh and Medi-Cal programs, and provides extra staffing for adult protective services, in-home supportive services, and child welfare services. The new budget, along with an anticipated allocation of $650 million in federal American Rescue Plan Act funding, is focused on economic recovery. The funding will provide senior and youth services, small business stimulus funds, permit fee waivers for the events industry, expanded broadband access, infrastructure, child care subsidies, food assistance, and mental health services. The budget also supports a newly established Office of Labor Standards and Enforcement. The budget calls for creation of a Homeless Solutions and Equitable Communities Department to streamline operations spread across several county agencies. It adds staff and funding to help veterans, youth, and high-need individuals with housing and other assistance. Separately, supervisors earmarked $85 million of the federal funds from the American Rescue Plan Act for services to help the homeless. $107 million in state and federal allocation will continue rental assistance through the Emergency Rental Assistance Program. The budget also increased funding for the CalWORKs Housing Support Program to help families in need find permanent housing. It also encourages development of accessory dwelling units by waiving fees and offering pre-approved plans. An increase of $25 million will expand the Innovation Housing Trust Fund and other housing initiatives to increase production and preservation of affordable housing. The budget calls for over $104 million for environmental protection, including reducing greenhouse gas emissions, planting trees, acquiring at least 500 acres of land for open space, protecting water quality in agriculture, and diverting waste from landfills. The newly established Office of Environmental and Climate Justice will see an increase in budget and staff. Funding will also broaden the environmental justice element in the county's general plan to reduce pollution exposure and promote public facilities, food access, safe and sanitary homes, and physical activities in underserved communities. The budget also funds a new subcommittee to enhance accessibility and open government to engage the public in the county budget process and supervisors' meetings. The subcommittee will also assess a Public Records Act portal, accessing archived public records, and the county's email retention policy. In addition, the new county budget calls for $282 million in capital projects to improve communities throughout the region. This includes a new Otay Mesa Fire Station, new Casa de Oro Library and Julian Library Community Room, and more than $70 million for new parks, trails, and recreational areas to enjoy the outdoors and preserve open space. The new fiscal year budget took effect on Thursday, July 1st. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
California's drought declaration has been expanded to include all but 8 counties in the state. San Diego is not on the list so far. However, Governor Gavin Newsom is asking all Californians to voluntarily cut their water use by 15%. And this applies to businesses and agriculture as well as residents. Meeting that target could save enough water to supply 1.7 million average households for 1 year, according to state officials, as some areas are running out of water. Newsom stressed that the reductions are voluntary and urged Californians to make common sense cuts, such as looking for leaks and running full loads of laundry and dishes. San Diego has sufficient water supplies so far, thanks to recent investments in adding new water storage facilities and a water purification program for water recycling. During the last drought from 2012 to 2016, Californians were actually ordered to cut their water use by an average of 25% statewide, and most people complied, cutting residential use by 21% back then. But those were mandatory cuts, and thus far, the requests are voluntary. California's Natural Resources Secretary Wade Crowfoot stressed that while California is no stranger to droughts, climate change is making conditions worse, since scorching heat is drying already parched soil and water supplies. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Alexa Oslowski with the Green Scene Report. A young mountain lion that has spent 4 months rehabbing at the San Diego Humane Society's Ramona Wildlife Center under the care of Project Wildlife was released back into the wild in late June. The 6-month-old cub and her sister came to San Diego Humane Society after their mother had been hit by a car, leaving them orphaned near a golf course in Orange County. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife determined the cubs could not fend for themselves in Rancho Santa Margarita and requested assistance from San Diego Humane Society. The second mountain lion cub had a forearm fracture and needed surgery, so she is still in care at the Ramona Wildlife Center and recovering. San Diego Humane Society's Project Wildlife team in Ramona is the first in California to work under the direction of California's Fish and Wildlife Department to rehab mountain lion kittens with the intention of releasing them back into the wild. While at the Ramona Wildlife Center, the mountain lions have been housed in large mammal compounds, limiting human interaction to only necessary veterinary exams and medical care. Christine Barton, the center's Director of Operations and Wildlife Rehabilitation, says, quote, "We are very excited to have been a part of this pilot program for mountain lion rehab in California, as typically rescued mountain lion kittens are routed for sanctuaries." San Diego Humane Society's Project Wildlife is the primary resource for wild animal rehab and conservation education in San Diego County. Each year, the facility gives nearly 13,000 injured, orphaned, and sick wild animals a second chance at life. Last year, the Humane Society announced a new Ramona campus where they specialize in caring for native apex predators and birds of prey, including hawks, owls, eagles, coyotes, bears, bobcats, and mountain lions.
This is Mitchell Murphy with a health alert. Tyson Foods has announced a recall of frozen, fully cooked chicken products due to possible listeria contamination. The tainted products were shipped nationwide to major retailers and institutions, including hospitals, nursing homes, restaurants, schools, and military sites. The products are linked to at least one death and several illnesses to date. Federal investigators are working to determine if there are any additional illnesses linked to these products. The frozen, fully cooked chicken products were produced between December 26, 2020 and April 13th of this year. The product subject to recall bear establishment number EST-P-7089 on the product bag or inside the USDA mark of inspection. Consumption of food contaminated with Listeria can cause listeriosis, a serious infection. Listeriosis can cause fever, muscle aches, headache, stiff neck, confusion, loss of balance, and convulsions, as well as gastrointestinal symptoms. In pregnant women, the infection can cause miscarriages, stillbirths, premature delivery, or life-threatening infection of the newborn. In addition, serious and sometimes fatal infections in older adults and persons with weakened immune systems. Listeriosis is treated with antibiotics. Persons in high-risk categories who experience flu-like symptoms within 2 months after eating contaminated food should seek medical care. If you have any of the recalled Tyson frozen, fully cooked chicken products, you should throw them away or return them to the retailer for a refund.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
On November 2nd, La Mesa will be holding a special election via mail-in ballots to replace Dr. Akila Weber, who left the City Council to serve as the 79th District State Assembly member. The winner will serve until the end of Dr. Weber's term on November 8, 2022. The nomination period opens on July 12th and closes on August 6th at noon. Candidate packets will be available in the city clerk's office by appointment only, and you can schedule an appointment by calling 619-667-1120. Candidates for the La Mesa City Council must be a U.S. citizen, a resident and registered voter in the city of La Mesa, and at least 18 years old by Election Day. Dr. Weber, a Democrat, was the first African-American woman to serve on La Mesa's City Council. But then she won a special election to serve in the Assembly, filling the vacancy left in the legislature after her mother, Shirley Weber, was appointed to fill a vacant Secretary of State position. La Mesa's City Council voted to hold a special election to fill the vacancy for the remainder of Dr. Weber's term, rather than make a less costly appointment, after members of the public voiced overwhelming support for a special election. The election follows a year of turbulent times in La Mesa, which in 2020 was rocked by racial justice protests and a riot, as well as the COVID-19 pandemic. Ballots for La Mesa's special election will be mailed to voters and can be dropped off in person at an official mail ballot drop-off location in the city from October 25th through November 2nd. In-person voting will only be available at the San Diego County Registrar of Voters office in San Diego from October 4th through November 2nd. You can find more information on La Mesa's special election to fill its city council vacancy on the City of La Mesa's website. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. And today my very special guest is El Cajon Councilman and Vice Mayor Gary Kendrick. Gary, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, Councilman Kendrick has recently led successful efforts to enact police reform measures, including a pilot program to outsource resources to social workers for nonviolent emergencies and fund de-escalation training for police. He's also pushed the city staff to draft an election integrity ordinance to help voters assure that candidates live in the districts where they're running. Plus, he's been an advocate for the city's major investment in funding to help the homeless, among other things. So, Gary, can we start by talking about those police reforms? In context here, we're coming off a year of people taking to the streets, calling for improvements in policing and racial justice changes. While you've rejected calls to defund the police, you instead pushed El Cajon to invest more money in policies that many racial justice advocates have been calling for, yet without compromising public safety by cutting policing. Can you tell us a little bit about what prompted you to take these actions?
Well, public safety is the number one mission of local government. We have to keep our citizens safe, and we have to keep our police officers safe as much as we can. And we received some federal money to use for various things, and I thought that we should take a big chunk of that, $500,000, and use it to contract out with social worker specialists that are trained and de-escalation. And the 911 operator will evaluate the calls coming in. And if it appears to be a non-violent call and the individual doesn't have any weapons, they may call out these specialists, and there are no guns involved, no weapons, and the specialist has training that we just can't provide to all our police officers. That's sure. what they do.
Yeah, we should note that it was just a couple of years ago that we had the Alfred Alongo incident where, unfortunately, it was a call about a man in mental distress, you know, walking in traffic, and he wound up being fatally shot by police when he pulled out of what they thought was a gun, and it turned out it was a vaping pen. But is that an example of the kind of thing that might be prevented by sending social workers out instead of police?
I can't speak about the Alongo case because it's in litigation right now. But there are cases where someone is clearly under the influence of drugs or there's some sort of mental problem. And sometimes it's just more appropriate, in my opinion, to send out a mental illness expert.
Yeah, it makes sense. The county has PERT teams, but not enough of them. I know with the Alongo case, they were called, couldn't make it. You know, we all know how that wound up. So it seems like it's something that would make a lot of sense. You've mentioned you hope this could perhaps even be a pilot program.
Oh, yes. This money is one-time money, and we'll see how that goes. $500,000 is a lot of money to spend, but it's something that clearly the council feels is very important. And no police officer wants to shoot somebody, and nobody wants to be shot.
Right.
So in this case, it would free up police officers to take care of some of the issues we have in a mid-sized city like El Cajon. I mean, there are murders and rapes and carjackings and, you know, all the sure. kinds of crimes that happen in a fairly large city. So this way that the police officers have their time freed up and they can get to calls more readily.
Yeah, it seems like a good idea. Now, it also includes money for some other things, right? Like de-escalation training for the police themselves?
Right. We actually took $100,000 out of our reserves, and that's actually a big deal. We very, very seldom take money out of reserves. This council has created a reserve that's actually three times the normal amount for a city our size. But that means during recessions and crises like the COVID pandemic, we were able to not cut services to the citizens and keep all the police and firefighters on the streets to make sure everyone was safe.
Well, that makes sense. And actually, I would think it's fiscally conservative in the sense that one lawsuit by someone over what they perceive as police brutality or wrongful death can be a lot more costly for the city than simply taking some proactive steps.
That's correct. It's good business for the city to send out the social workers when appropriate. As you said, there's one lawsuit, just the attorney's fees we had to pay, even if we win the case, could far outweigh what we spend on police training
sure.
and the social workers.
Gary, I should note that you are a Republican, as are your colleagues on the council, and this passed unanimously, 4-0 with the mayor absent, I understand. Was it difficult to persuade your other council members to support something like this? What kind of reactions did you get when you first brought it to them?
Well, I don't think it was very difficult because I emphasized that it was good business to do this and it could save money and save lives. And my fellow council members are very cognizant of the issues that some people have in the city. And we're not afraid to kind of step outside the box sometimes and really do what's right.
Yeah, I can think of a couple of examples before where you kind of bucked the trend there, or the powers that be, such as landmark legislation you pushed through to protect children from tobacco and to restrict alcohol sales to
you know, serial inebriates and things like that. And some of those were upheld by courts and became programs emulated in other places, right?
That's correct. In fact, we've always been at the forefront of protecting children from alcohol and tobacco and illegal drugs.
Now, on election integrity, this issue arose as background here due to a residency challenge that was brought against a city council candidate who did not win his election, but you wanted to make sure that issue hopefully doesn't happen again. It turns out, unfortunately, there's a state law that does not make it a crime to run in a district where you don't live, unbelievably, to me at least, as long as you move into the district if elected. Do you think that's fair, Gary? Why or why not?
No, I don't think so, because the voters clearly wanted someone that was familiar with the district to represent them. And we could end up in a case where someone runs every election cycle, they don't live in the district. And if they don't live in the district, they really don't understand the issues of the people that live in that district.
Yeah, and you just went through redistricting, and the whole point of it was to create, you know, have each district have its own representation from people who live there, including carving out a majority-minority district there, as California voting law requires. So this does seem to sort of run counter to the spirit of the law. So tell me about, within the limitations of the state law, what you proposed that the city should do.
Well, what we propose is that people have to prove that they live within the district where they're running. And this is going to be completely voluntary.
So they could choose not to do it, but that would then raise a red flag with voters that maybe an opponent could, you know, latch onto.
That's right. And I bet if someone refused to give the information, the driver's license, copies of utility bills, I bet you East County Magazine would be right there looking at them.
We will be doing the public
with a microscope.
We will. We'll be putting those public records requests in and holding the candidates accountable, Gary. So when does the staff's draft legislation of this come back before the council for a vote?
Within just a few weeks. It's something that all the council members think is very important, because when someone cheats the public that like that, it's a direct attack on our representative form of government.
Yes, it is. Let's talk about the homeless, Gary. This is probably one of the biggest problems in East County, the entire county, of course. And it's become even worse in many areas during COVID-19, when the homeless couldn't even access, you know, bathrooms, let alone other kind of services. And yet, El Cajon has chosen to make a pretty substantial investment. You already, I should say, had more homeless housed than any of the other East County communities that have zero shelters. That includes the county unincorporated areas and the other three cities out here, Santee, La Mesa, and Lemon Grove. So can you tell us about the findings of the latest point in time count of the homeless?
Well, actually, we just got the information for 2021, January of 2021.
Okay.
And the data from the county shows that El Cajon housed over 700 homeless persons in one night.
Wow.
The other East County cities housed zero.
And this is a big increase even for El Cajon over the prior year, correct?
Right. It's about a 20% increase.
So how did you do that?
Giving out homeless vouchers. And I might add that years ago, the city council, on a 3-2 vote, and I voted for this program to establish a East County Transitional Living Center on the eastern end of the city. And we now house about 148 children, usually with just the mother, about 150 men at the end of a rigorous alcohol and drug program. And I actually, over the last 5 years, have had about six different people that used to be homeless living at my house that had graduated from the program.
That is really admirable. I can't think of another public official that's actually walked the walk and taken homeless people into their own house after they went through one of these transitional rehab program. So I think that's commendable, Gary. The East County Transitional Living Center just recently expanded. They're building or have built new buildings now. And I understand that the city had a hand in that, correct?
Right. A bunch of local contractors got together and volunteered to build additional housing for the homeless at the East County Transitional Living Center. It will house 60 persons, and they donated all of the labor and all of the materials. And our city staff has volunteered to help coordinate that, and the building inspectors are going to be there the entire day, maybe 12 to 14 hours.
Wow.
While they do the work. And they're doing this on their own time, on their day off.
Very nice. We should mention, by the way, I just saw on the Live Nation website that the first in-person concert they're going to be doing at the Magnolia is actually a fundraiser for the East County Transitional Living Center. And I guess the star of the show is none other than Mayor Bill Wells playing his piano, saxophone. So that's kind of interesting. You can go to the Live Nation site and look that up if you're interested in checking out that concert.
Yes, our mayor is actually a very accomplished musician.
Yeah, he is. I've heard him before. So the city also put in some money of their own to help the homeless in the past year. Gary, can you fill us in a little bit on that?
Yes, we spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, mostly allocated through community development block grants from the federal government. We choose where that money goes. And we give East County Transitional Living Center money every year.
Yeah. And are there other programs as well for the homeless that the city helps fund?
Oh, there are numerous programs for the homeless. We have a program that gets them bus tickets to go back to relatives after the relatives say, oh, we'll take care of them. We'll help them get back on their feet.
Yeah, so, your animal shelter, I know, will let them leave their dogs there if they have a dog and you're on the streets and they need to go get, say, a medical appointment, something like that, a social work appointment.
That's right. You know, a dog is a source of stability for a homeless person. They really love their dogs. So it's just one more impediment that we're trying to remove to get them into a program and back on their feet.
Yeah, that's good. You also approved, or the city council approved, a pilot program for essentially tiny homes, similar to tiny homes. I think they called them emergency sleeping cabins at a church in El Cajon. What's the status on that?
We're moving forward with it. It's a pilot program, and they're the little tiny houses. They can use restrooms at the church and some portable restrooms, and it gets them off the street. Actually gives them an address so they can go out and get jobs.
Nice. Yeah. Gary, what else is coming up in El Cajon that you would like our listeners to know about?
Well, the car show is going full blast right now.
Yeah.
We have the Monkees coming to the Magnolia in September.
That sounds great. And and the concerts on the green are back out
right
there.
They're back. The restaurants that had the outdoor dining, they're going full blast right now. And you can go down there and hear the music playing on Friday nights. We're finally getting back to normal.
That's great. Well, Gary, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine Radio Show.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with author Stephen McGinty, author of the new book, The Dive: The Untold Story of the World's Deepest Submarine Rescue. My guest is also an award-winning journalist and producer of documentaries. His documentary, Fire in the Night, is based on the book of the same name and won the Audience Award at the Edinburgh International Film Festival and won Best Single Documentary. Stephen McGinty lives in Scotland. Welcome, Stephen. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
No, thank you for inviting me.
Let's begin with the story itself, the race against time that took place first to locate the Pisces 3 and then execute the deepest rescue in maritime history. What first sparked your interest in the topic and why write a book?
Well, I first heard about it when I was on a cruise, of all things, many years ago. I was on a cruise and I was sitting at the captain's table and he told me the story that of this incredible sequence of events that had taken place just off the coast of Ireland, well, about 150 miles off the coast of Ireland back in 1973. And I'd always been fascinated by the deep. I'd always been fascinated by oceans. And I filed it away. And I was amazed that no one had actually told a modern story about it, written a modern book. And I was looking for a new subject for a book and decided to dust it down as an idea. And when I looked at it, it's just the most incredible story. I mean, my goal was to write a nonfiction thriller, and the bare bones of the story there were great material because the story is really quite incredible.
So you didn't have to make it up. It was already there.
Well, that's the beauty of nonfiction. You know, you don't have to make it up because the characters are fantastic. I mean, to give you your listeners a kind of an idea of the situation, you know, that these guys, Roger Mallinson and Roger Chapman, found themselves in. They were in a small Pisces submersible, and they eventually sank to 1,600, 1,700 feet. So, but the way I always describe it to people is try and imagine you're in a phone box, a kind of relatively large phone box with your friend, and the phone box is sitting at the bottom of the Empire State Building, and you look out of the window and the Atlantic Ocean rolls in to a height 10 stories above the very top of the Empire State Building. Oh. Everything is pitch dark. Then you start bleeding oxygen. And then you realize that the people on the surface don't know exactly where you are, where you've sank. And when they do know where you are, either way, it's going to be 2 days at least before they can start the rescue. And then when they do start the rescue, everything goes wrong.
How did they get trapped in the first place? How did that happen?
Well, what happened was that they were doing a kind of standard job. This was 1973, and their job was to pilot the small commercial submersible, a Pisces 3. And what their job was this was back in 1973 when there was the Cantac cable, which was the Canadian transatlantic telephone cable, and it ran from Britain to Canada, and it had recently been laid, and this was high technology at the time. This allowed 1,700 phone calls to be made at any one time between North America and the UK. And I try and imagine that, you know, that was great. 1,700 phone calls could be made at any time.
Right.
Now, their job was, the cable had been laid, but their job was to bury it because it was sitting on the surface, and at that depth, it could still have been hauled up by any kind of deep sea fishing trawlers. So their job was to dig a small trench and to let it drop into the trench. What happened was they did an 8-hour shift. They went to the surface, and this is where it gets tragic for them and difficult to imagine today. At the time, the way that they tracked these submersibles, it was almost like Jaws, where they fired the arrow into the shark, and it was a barrel at the top. What happened was there was a kind of large flotation device that was on the top of the surface, and it was connected to a cable to the submarine, and then 2,000 feet of rope, effectively. So that's how they knew where it was. So when it got to the surface, the diver disconnected this cable, so they no longer knew where it was because it was on the surface. But then what happened was there was a kind of a freak accident whereby a tow rope coiled onto the back of the submarine and it accidentally lifted up a hatch. And what then happened was a ton of water poured into the back of the submarine, and that obviously increased the weight of it, tipped it down, and it sank. First of all, it sank to 170 feet where it was caught on a tow rope, and it managed to last on a tow rope for maybe 3 or 4 minutes while they were frantically trying to sort of dump weight off the submarine. And then the tow rope snapped and the submarine fell another 1,500 feet and crash landed on the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. And at that point, when the they realized what happened. You know, they crash landed in the bottom. They knew they were deeper than any submarine had ever been rescued before. So they knew they both knew they were in serious trouble.
And so explain the danger.
Well, the danger is twofold. One, you're in a steel coffin, effectively. You're in a submarine, but effectively it's a very tight space. You know, it's maybe 5 feet in diameter or less. They don't know where you are on the surface. Because although you left the surface at a certain point, they don't know which direction they plummeted. They've also got a limited amount of oxygen supply. They've got roughly, if they were acting normally, they would have, moving around the submarine as they knew it, they would have 30 hours of oxygen left. Their job was now to lie very still, not to speak, and to be very calm. And by doing that, it was estimated they could stretch that oxygen out to maybe 3 days. The problem, though, was that in order for them to be rescued at that time when they crashed, the only way to rescue them was to get other submarines onto the spot, i.e. down to where they were. The only submarines that could do that, one was in the North Sea, one was in Canada, on the east coast of Canada, and the other one, which was fantastic, was in San Diego, where the CURV team operated from. Now, CURV was high technology in 1973. It was a remote-controlled submarine, a remote-controlled effective submarine device. And what happened then was that there was a massive rescue operation that was launched. They were stuck on the bottom of the Atlantic. And then phone calls were made to the teams in San Diego and the teams in Canada. And everything swung into action. Massive Hercules aircraft were prepared. The teams in San Diego and the teams in Halifax, Nova Scotia, got everything together, drove at speed to the airports, put all their equipment, men, submarines, every piece of technical, long ropes, and managed to get into the air as quickly as possible. So then they were flying over to Cork, where they landed. The ship that was on the surface then had to leave them after another ship had come to maintain the spot. The Vickers Voyager sailed 13 hours back to Cork, picked everyone up in Cork, got the submarines on board, then got them back to the rescue. And effectively what happened over a 25 to 36 hour period was a desperate rescue attempt, because they knew that every hour counted, every minute counted, every second counted. And these two men were running out of oxygen. And what they did was they sent down a mini submarine, first of all, to try and rescue them. The problem was the mini submarine had a rope gripped in its hand. They have these kind of talons, effectively. But the problem was the rope was too buoyant. So when it got down to about 1,000 feet, the buoyancy of the rope was too great and it ripped it out of the talon. So they don't have a rope to fix it with. They also don't know where it is. So the first mission ends in failure. The second mission goes down. The second submarine, which is the Canadians, go down. And they're down for 8 to 10 hours and they can't find it. As I've described it in the book, is they know where the haystack is. They know there's a haystack down there. They just don't know where the needle is. They just don't know where Pisces 3 is. They're trying to track it by sonar. So the first, second submarine is down for 10 hours, goes back to the surface, goes back down again. And what they try to do is they get the men to sing, to try and sing so that the higher notes they might be able to pick up on sonar. So they're singing, you know, we're here. And eventually they manage to find them. So there's this very moving scene where the two men in the submarine are looking out the porthole windows, because all they see is blackness and a tiny wash of crud, of bits of debris or animals that are floating past, the occasional fish. They can also hear dolphins and porpoises down there, and they interfere with the radio, the underwater telephone, as it's known. But there's an amazingly moving moment when the Canadians in their small mini submarine get closer and closer, and suddenly the light outside the submarine goes from pitch black and slowly begins to lighten and lighten and lighten. And that's when they realize they've been found.
Wow. What a story. And I'm trying to picture their response when they're asked to sing.
Well,
and if the dolphins sang.
The thing was, it then, although they've actually been found, the Canadians have to attach a hook to the kind of lift point in the submarine. And I've described it as like threading a needle while wearing a suit of armor. And they managed to do it. But the point is, in another freak accident, no sooner is the rope with the hook attached than it rolls out and falls off. And they're scrambling to try and get the rope back on, but they can't get it on to the right point. They've connected it, but it's not to a point strong enough to lift it. And then they have to send down another sub. That doesn't work. And then the Americans, and again, there's a time's running out. So what they do is they then, the Americans finally arrive on the scene, our boys from San Diego, you know, guys like Larry Brady, Jim McFarland. That's the Canadians. Larry Brady was the Americans from San Diego. Bob Watts, Tom Wojcicki, Denny Holstein, John DeFriest, William Sanderson, and William Patterson. You're from San Diego, so I thought I'd mention all the local boys there.
Right.
But they are called in, and they arrive on the scene. And again, things going wrong. They're told to power up Curve to send it down. And there's a massive electronic sort of system that powers this thing. And they switch it on because they're about to send it down. But what they don't know is that while they've been traveling out from Cork, salt water from the sea spray and the waves has got into the circuits, and literally as soon as they flick it on, the whole thing blows. And we're at a time where every minute counts. They calculate it's going to be 4 hours for them to hand rewire all the circuit boards. And this is when everything is going wrong. But eventually the Americans get down, and after one team puts down a rope, the Americans get another one on. So it's just, yeah, it's to say that it was a roller coaster of a rescue, it does a dreadful disservice to roller coasters because it was far worse.
Right. And what was the state of the crew members?
Well, they were lucky in that Roger Mallinson, who is still alive, and I interviewed him extensively for the book, always said that he was so pleased that he was down with Roger Chapman, the Jolly Rogers, as they were known by the time they got back to shore, described by the British press. But Roger Chapman was ex-Navy, and he was a submariner, and had been on nuclear submarines before joining this commercial small submarine crew, Vickers. And Mallinson always said that he didn't think they would have survived if he'd been down with anyone else, because both of them were level-headed, and although they were terrified, they had that British stiff upper lip where they just suppressed it. They bit through the pain and frustration, but it was exceedingly difficult. Try and imagine that stress where you're in there and oxygen's bleeding out because you're using oxygen. You've also got to operate the scrubber, which takes out carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and that's dependent on the batteries, and the batteries could go at any minute. And they're also, because of as carbon dioxide rises in the atmosphere, you get splitting headaches and pain in your joints. And they're also worrying about their families.
Sure.
So it was, what was fascinating about the story was that they both said, Chapman in his memoir, which he'd written a couple of years after the events of 40 odd years ago, and Mallinson in interviews with me, they both said that the worst part of the whole experience was the lift, because it took them 2.5 hours to get from the bottom to the top. And because of the way the waves were going and the ship they were attached to, they were like a giant fish attached to a rod, and the rod kept going up and down, so the submarine itself kept battering back and forth, so they were like sardines rattled in a very violent tin.
And that part, that being the worst part, are they talking about physically or emotionally or both?
I think it was two things. It was physically, because of the being battered about inside the submarine, and also the stress of it, because they didn't understand the device that was hooking them on. They thought it was a hook, like an open-ended hook. So in their head, all this shaking about meant they could fly off any second. And then it was the fact that they kept stopping, and at one point other divers had to go down while this thing's thrashing about and fix a final line onto it. So it's a remarkable story. But for me, it's a remarkable story in that it's about the brotherhood of the sea. You know, this notion that if you are in peril in the sea, all other ships will come to your aid. Everything's put on hold. And the priority is, how do we get these men up? So we had the Canadians, you know, the amazing team from Heiko coming over, mm-hmm. Like, you know, Al Trice, Mike McDonald, Jim McBeth. They all fly over. You've got the San Diego team I've talked mm-hmm. about. And you've also got their own team from Vickers Voyager. It's a remarkable story.
The determination.
Yeah, I think it teaches you. There's a great quote I've always loved from Winston Churchill, where he said, "Never, ever, ever give in." And I think it's very true. And that's certainly what they did. Peter Messervy, who was a kind of former commander who led the rescue along with Al Trice, it was tenacity. And mm-hmm. it was Al Trice always used to joke, if it was easy, everyone would be doing it.
Right.
Now, he said that when he was looking at the helicopter that was supposed to bring them rope from another ship, and the helicopter had misjudged the weight of the rope. Oh. So the helicopter took off with this basket carrying all this rope underneath it. And literally, as soon as it took off, it started plummeting down towards the sea because it was dragged down by the rope, and it had to jettison the rope or else it would have crashed. So suddenly this rope they need is bobbing about on the surface of the North Sea in the midst of a storm. So that was just another thing that went wrong.
My goodness. How do you think you would respond if you were to find yourself in this kind of situation?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would have coped as well as either Chapman or Mallinson. I think we claustrophobia would have been...
That's what I was thinking, yes.
It would have been excruciating. And uh-huh. also that sense of panic, that also... the way your mind operates in these situations where you're constantly projecting about all the things that could go wrong, everything that had gone wrong, but then all the things that still could go wrong. So I think, if you want to imagine what it'd be like, just imagine yourself in that telephone box at the bottom of the Empire State Building yeah. and then the Atlantic Ocean rolling in. I think it would have been hard to say the least.
I can't help thinking a discipline of mind.
Well, I suppose the other thing is we never know what we're capable of until we're in that situation.
That's true.
But the key is not to be in a small submarine that sinks.
Right. What was it like to research this book for you?
The fascinating thing about it was I had my plan. Again, there's a great line I always love, which applies to this rescue operation as applied to the writing of the book, because there's a good, you know, the phrase, you know, how do you make God laugh? Tell him your plans. And of course, my plan was to travel over to San Diego to meet the guys, travel to Canada to interview them, to go down to the Lake District to meet Roger Mallinson and Roger Chapman's wife and widow. But of course, the pandemic kicked in and no one was going anywhere. So the entire book was conducted, all the research was done from my house, interviewing people over the phone, over Zoom, just getting documents that I could, the original. What was great is a lot of it was based on paperwork, so it was the original report into the crash. Mm-hmm. I got access to that. Also, the teams in Canada and in America had written their own documents about it, so I was able to use a lot of those material, and also found old recordings. So in a project like this, it's all about stitching the material together. You know, you have your facts, you know the circumstance. I've always believed in three C's when it comes to projects like this. It's all about character, context, and chronology. And if you can get those three elements and lay them out and then think, how do I tell this in a way that's absolutely factually correct to the best of your ability? But will engage the reader as much as possible. How can I put the reader in the experiences of these men? It was a great story to write, and also because it's got such a happy ending. You know, I hope that even though people will read from the blurb that they survived, that when you're in the midst of it, you forget.
Right.
Because that was the, I think the reason what one of the things I wanted to push people into it was to to write a lot of it in the present tense, because we know these guys didn't know that they were going to pull off this rescue. Messervy at 3 o'clock on Saturday morning, when he knew he didn't yet have a lift line on this submarine, and they had 6 hours of oxygen left. He'd been at it for 26 hours and they hadn't got a line on it. Obviously, we know that he pulled it off, but to be in that position, and he's just got a phone call from the other ship, from the Americans, we're just about to send Curve down, but it's blown its fuses. There's going to be a 3 or 4 hour delay. Yeah, these are very tough situations. Yeah,
it's like dying any minute for hours.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they were doing. They were dying down there, mm-hmm. and they managed to get them back. In fact, that was the touching thing, because again, all these are all hardy men of the sea and mm-hmm. you know, white blue collar workers pulling together from around the world to save them. And I think it is telling that when they finally got to the surface, on the ships around them, a lot of the guys who'd been working on it were at the railings watching, and as soon as it hit the surface, people talked about how they just burst into tears.
It's a wonderful ending. One last question, kind of apart from this particular amazing story, what after this, what book or documentary are you going to work on next?
Yeah, well, I've got a new idea for a book, which I can't kind of go into all the details yet.
Okay.
To what it is, but I'm developing that. It's again, the plan is it'll be a non-fiction thriller. Mm-hmm. I write factual books. That's my kind of forte. But the other project that we're obviously keen to do is we're developing. The Dive has been optioned by Mark Gordon, the producer of Saving Private Ryan and Speed, and we're developing it now.
Wow.
With a great team to develop it as a film. So
yes.
I'm looking forward to helping out with that and to seeing how that all comes out.
Yes, that would be a wonderful film. Well, Stephen McGinty, thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasure Bookshelf and hearing all about your adventure, vicarious adventure.
Yes, indeed. Tales of the Sea.
So thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
For further information on Stephen McGinty and his book, The Dive, please visit him on Twitter at SG McGinty, and that's spelled SGMCGINTY. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.